This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to another To Hell in a Handbasket podcast. And now, here's your host, Dolly Diamond. A little yellow
basket. Oh, good evening, everybody. I would welcome, of course, to Hell in a Handbasket with me, Dolly Diamond. Well, tonight I have a young man who's I've admired for many, many years. What a unique and wonderful voice he has. He's also got a unique and wonderful personality to go with it, and you're going to see that over this next hour. I introduce to you now the very lovely John Jackson. Hello.
Hello there, Dolly. How are you?
Really well, and it's so lovely to have you on.
Thank you very much. I'm very honoured. I've never been the subject of anything in my life, really.
Well, it's you know what's great about this is that it's an hour where we get to know you a little bit better. So there's nothing that you don't know. That's what I like.
Yes, well, that's fantastic. If nobody knows anything, then no one can disprove anything.
Well, exactly. Now, you've got an interesting life, which is one of the reasons I wanted to have you on. Obviously, I admire you as a singer. Now, you're an opera singer, really, by training, aren't you?
I am, yes. I trained as a countertenor, which is one of the highest sort of male register. I sound more like a mezzo-soprano, so a woman with a sort of a rich and fruity voice. But, you know, it's very difficult to make your living doing that. And also, I have a bit of a rebellious streak, and I don't really like doing all the traditional things that you are supposed to do, I suppose.
Now, I want to go back to, you were born in Queensland. Now, I don't know this area of Queensland. It's called Warwick, is it?
It is.
What's Warwick like? What was that growing up as a little boy?
Warwick was wonderful growing up. It's a city with a population of 10,000 people. And as you drive into Warwick, which is on the Darling Downs, which is mostly, you know, farming, as you drive in there, there's a big sign and it says, "Welcome to Warwick, 10,000 friendly people." And that has been there my entire life. Even though the population of Warwick has grown, the sign is still correct.
Yes, and but it would have gone up quite a bit over the years, I would imagine, wouldn't
it? Yeah, apparently it's more like 18,000 now, wow. but only 10,000 of them are friendly.
Yeah, that's probably right. And, well, how funny. Then, so growing up there, now your mum Bob and your mum, your dad Bob and your mum Mona, I beg your
yes,
pardon.
Yes, that's right.
Don't get those mixed up, do we?
Well, no.
And well, I like reading about your dad because he sounds like a wonderful man. Now, he was quite a well-known man about town, wasn't he? And
he had a
very big firm of panel beaters.
That's right. He had about 40, at one point nearly 50 guys working for him. So there was panel beating, there was a service station, there was mechanics, an engine rebuilding, coach building. So he would rebuild furniture moving vans, wrecking, spare parts, spray painting, upholstery, everything. So as you drove into Warwick, on either side of the main road, it said Jackson's. So people used to call it Jacksonville. And it made me very popular as a child because what little kids love are trucks. They love trucks.
And did you love them, though? Because, I mean, you know, we were getting in on Saturday morning. Were you in there, you know, helping your dad out in there? Or?
Oh, no.
No, it wouldn't have been very me either.
No, I wasn't allowed.
Oh, no. All right.
No, there were a couple of reasons. One, it was dangerous.
Yes.
And number two, my parents didn't like children working or doing anything like that. Sometimes we used to help at the service station, but my mother didn't approve of that.
Oh.
So we weren't allowed to. She said, "I loathe children serving in shops. I can't stand children serving me. I can't stand it." So we weren't allowed to do that. She was a bit funny like that.
Oh, you were lucky. I had to start work when I was very little. I think I remember to earn my pocket money.
Really? Yes. What did you do?
Oh, all the horrible chores, I think. You know, I used to have to pour my mother's drinks and things like that. I was constantly working. Constantly. I want to talk about your family because it's quite a big family, isn't it?
Yeah, five kids.
How many brothers and sisters?
Four boys and one girl.
And I think I was reading about your eldest brother, who Stephen, is it? Is
yeah, that's right,
right
Steve.
He came out as being gay well before it was, well, I mean, it's popular now, isn't it? Let's face it. It's popular in the sense of it's not as difficult a journey as it probably would have been for your brother in 1972.
Yeah, 1972.
They're very bold, wasn't it?
Well, he was very different. He used to wear caftans around the house and everything. You got to remember, this is 1972.
Yes.
And he used to blow dry his hair, and he had lots of
art
books.
Could be me.
It could be you. But I absolutely adored him. Strangely, it was my mother who was the least accepting of it. She just couldn't deal with it. And my father was the one who dealt with it quite well, because he'd sort of had quite a bit of a life, and he had been married before, and he had had children before, and we only found this out after he died, because as it turns out, he hadn't actually bothered to divorce the first Mrs. Jackson before he married my mother, which is hilarious, you know, at the time. But it was now we laugh, but then it was shameful. But he'd had a pretty colourful life, so he just said to my brother, "Well, that's just the way it is, you know, it is what it is." Too bad, you know. My mother was really not accepting of it, and she took back his car, and she, you know, she took back his, because in those days, like now, you had to pay to go to university.
Yes.
And so she was very down on that. But secretly, my dad was paying his tuition and bought him another car, because my dad was in the car trade, so why not?
Oh, yes, he had them there, didn't he?
So he gave him a car, and he paid his rent, and he used to go down on the weekends and visit him to make sure he was okay. He and his boyfriend, Tom, who became a very well-known concert pianist. And in his will, when he passed away, when my dad died, he made provision in the will. He'd already organised his own funeral, and he asked that Tom, my brother's first boyfriend, be a pallbearer, and he did. He came, and he was.
Wow. How lovely. Well, he sounds like a bit of a catch, your dad, when he was around. No wonder he married twice.
Yes.
Well, do you have anything to do with the other children from the first marriage? You do?
I do. Oh, no, I've never met them.
Oh, we don't know where they are.
No. Oh, well, we do. One. I have
They're not some of the friendly people of Warwick, are they?
They're not. They're not from Warwick at all.
Oh.
No, one of them is in the US military. He's a man in his 60s, so he'll be almost retired from the military now. And I have a sister who would be maybe in her mid to late 60s, who's somewhere. I don't know where. I'm the last. Well, I'm the last legitimate one.
Yes. But are you the youngest out of all the children then? Wow. And were you spoilt then when you were growing up, do you think? Or just more by your dad, but not so much by your mum then, really?
Well, I'm told that I was spoilt. I mean, I still had to do chores and things like that, but not working outside the home.
I think you were spoiled.
I probably.
Because I had to work.
Well.
I'm joined by the very lovely John Jackson. And, well, I want to talk about your dad again because, he sounds like a wonderful man to me. And I think when you were about 14 years of age, he said to you, "John, I believe that you," I don't know, the words might not be exactly right, but he basically said to you that he believed you were gay.
That's right, yeah.
Which is very bold, isn't it?
It was. He, because I remember we were out for dinner, and my uncles and aunts were sort of they were sort of country people, and they're saying, "Oh, I suppose you've got a young girlie."
Yes.
And I went, no. Anyway, my dad took me aside and he said, "Look, I think that you like your brother." And I said, "Really?" He goes, "Well, you know what's going to happen." And he said, "What's happening is that, you know, people notice that you're different and they're calling you names and that sort of thing." And he said, "You can't take it from people because it's the way God made you. There's nothing you can do about it. It's just the way you are. So you've got to stand up for yourself." And he said, if you're going to be the way you are, you've got to be tough and you've got to have courage. And he said, "So if people call you names, don't take it from them." And my mother would say, because I'd come home and say that somebody had called me names or they were mean to me, and my mother would say, "Oh, ignore them." And my father would say, "Don't smack him in the mouth, like punch him in the nose, kick him in the shins. Don't let them get away with it, because once they start..."
They won't stop.
They won't stop.
No.
And, you know, I remember kids at school who were the subject of the barbs of other kids, and, you know, they sort of shriveled up and hid in the library and you know, were terrified, all just because they didn't stand up. I remember after that, a boy called David Bowler called me names out the front of the science class. So I smacked him in the mouth and blood went everywhere and it was awful. And he punched me in the eye and we both went to the office for fighting. And I came home with a shiner and my dad was so proud of
me. Yes.
He said, good on you, Barney, because that's what he used to call me. And my mum was, she was going, oh, it's terrible. You shouldn't encourage him to fight and all this sort of thing. And he said, he stood up for himself and he said, no, they're going to think twice before they do anything to him again because he'll fight back. And it's true.
Yes.
They left me alone for the rest of school because people went, don't, no. Because a new kid would come to school and they think, oh, I'll say something to this fairy, and his mates would go, don't, because he will fight you.
Good on you.
So, yeah.
It was. Yeah, I agree. It's the way to do it.
Yeah, you just got to tell people to get stuffed and you can't take it.
No, you're exactly right. I mean, you know, you don't want to encourage people to be going around having fights everywhere. But, I mean, I think when you're that age, you know, you've got to stand up for yourself.
Now,
let's on that note, let's have a little look if there's number one of your first thing to go to possibly into hell in a handbasket. What have you got for me, John Jackson?
The thing I want to go to hell in a handbasket is casual homophobia.
Oh, there we go. Yes.
Most specifically, say when something bad happens, or let's say you stub your toe and people say gay and instead of shit. And I really, really, really hate that.
Yeah, it does seem to be something they've adopted over the last few years, doesn't it?
It does.
Also, when they adopt something like that, I always imagine that it'll go away as soon as it arrived, but it's one that's really stuck around,
it has.
I don't know why.
I went and saw a stage show. It was completely ruined by it, because otherwise it was a very good show, and I knew the people in it, but I never really said anything about it. Because I thought, I don't have anything positive to say. I really want to say, you just ruined everything. I wanted to get up and leave, but it wasn't that kind of venue. I would have made a scene. I would have had to walk right through the action. But, yeah, I just think it's just unacceptable. I didn't take it then, and I'm not going to take it now.
No, you're quite right. And I think with, you know, over the years, as we've just said, you know, kids have been picking on other kids for years, and so that will never, ever stop that.
No.
As much as we try, you've got to stand up for yourself. And there are many other ways of expressing that you've stubbed your toe or you don't like something. And doing it in such a derogatory way towards, you know, gay people is not the way. Listen, John Jackson, I have not a doubt in my mind that that's a gay is definitely going to hell in a handbasket. Oh, it had to, didn't it?
It had to.
We had to get rid of that.
It had to. Had to go.
Now, I remember seeing you many years ago in an absolutely wonderful, wonderful group called the Great Big Opera Company, which you were the star of, weren't you?
I was. I was the only singer in the whole opera company. So it caused quite a few incidents over the years, you know, arriving in a venue as the act, Great Big Opera Company, and you get a dressing room for 20 people, and there's just three of us sitting in the middle, and they say, where's the rest of the company? And you go, it's a joke.
Yes.
It's a joke.
Because for people that get the idea, really, it isn't about a whole group or a company, though, but it was mainly you as the singer with this wonderful music, but it was mainly focused on your voice. Which, you know, how for instance, you had singing lessons, you were younger, I guess, I read that you describe yourself as going through a period of probably excess. Is that all right? You know, with drinking and things like that. And that nowadays,
yes,
having gone through all of that, you feel like your voice is stronger than it ever was.
Oh, much. Yes, I think it's a much better instrument than it ever was before.
Is that lucky, though? Because, I mean, so many people go through that sort of period of excess where they drink too much and, you know, they often, by the end of that, find that their voice is no longer there or it's been affected by it. How do you think yours has come so strong then?
I think it's because I didn't use it. I didn't sing at all.
I just you weren't abusing it at the time.
I wasn't abusing it.
Perhaps yourself.
I was abusing me.
Yeah.
But somehow I don't know. I'm just lucky, you know, because, you know, when I was at college, there were some people saying that voice isn't going to last. You know, the way you sing, what you do to that voice, it can't last. And I'm now in my 50s and it still works. And actually, it's got better. It's a much better voice. What's weird, though, the most surprising aspect of it is that it's grown both ways. It hasn't just got deeper, because the voice does become deeper with age, but also it's now higher as well. So when we had to rejig some old songs from the late 80s and early 90s, we had to take them up a tone, which is unusual, because normally you'd be taking them down a tone. But, you know, for some reason it's sort of match fit again. I don't know. I'm just lucky.
And with a countertenor voice, is that the sort of voice that always stays a countertenor, or can that go lower into like a, you know, more of a male register, a typical male register?
Well, I guess so. But I think because I guess if I was a woman, my voice would be mezzo soprano. I guess I'd just drop to contralto.
Yes, but yours hasn't dropped though, has it?
No, but I've got a way to go yet. So I might become I might be a basso profundo by the time I'm finished. I don't know, but
sounds painful.
But I think I already sing a bit of bass, so I'll just just stick with what I can do, I suppose. When I first started singing, because I had about 6 years where I didn't really sing, only a little bit. When I first started singing again, it was a bit like a rusty push bike, you know. It was a little hard. I couldn't believe when I listened to them, or I looked at the music I used to sing, I can't believe I sang those notes. I thought, oh my God, how did I ever get up that high?
Yes. I'm joined by John Jackson, and I loved reading about, I've loved it with all my guests, reading a little bit about their lives. You have written the most, though, out of all the guests, and I've absolutely loved, no, I say that in a good way, and one of the stories that really caught my eye, well, also you dabbled, in a little bit of drag for a little while there, and I think it was your dad that said you should join with Lake Earls. God, he sounds like a lovely man.
He did. Yes. He did say that to me, because I used to like dressing up and putting on a little bit of a show at home, and it was disapproved of at first when I was young, and then my mother's GP said, no, it's a good thing, because all kids go through a gender identity thing, and it's better just to let them do it and they'll work it out for themselves. And that worked. But then I discovered Mae West when I was a youngster as well, and because I wanted to be her and I wanted to talk like her and I wanted to, you know, all that sort of thing. And so I got myself a frock together I did a bit of remodeling on an old Eva Gabor Tovar wig, which I saved up for. And
where did you buy this? Did you get it? You know, because you wouldn't have got this online when you save up something. You know?
Oh no, I would have. I think I went to Myers when we went to Toowoomba, and I bought myself a wig, and I made myself a little feathered headdress. I found I made myself a red dress, and I trimmed it. I got this red feathered hat in an op shop, and I pulled all the feathers off it, and I turned it into a bit of a head spray, and I decorated the dress in it, because the dress was pretty shoddily made. And my dad suggested that I do a number, do a Mae West number there was some gig at a winery, and so he got me to do it. And I'm trying to think what I did, but you know, I had a few feathers, and I think I just started talking like that, and I think I sang "I'm No Angel" or something like that, and he loved it, and he said to me, you know, that you're really good at that, and you sound just like a woman when you sing. He said you could do that for a living. And of course, I didn't know that he would have known anything about that. But then he revealed that he'd been to Lay Girls, and he said, I think in those days it was Peter and Johnny Mozell. That's what they were called. Peter and Johnny Mozell ran it, who were probably a gay couple and ran this place. And I didn't know them. And Dad said, so look, because I was, you know, going to finish school the end of the next year. And he said, well, you know, if you finish school, you don't want to hang around here, because in Warwick, you could work at the bacon factory, or you could work at the bacon factory. That was
about your dad's panel beating.
On my dad's panel beating business. He would have given me the shittiest jobs in the entire place just to make me leave, because he told me I should have been on the stage, not doing something else. So my brother heard about a performing arts course at the university in Toowoomba, and he got me to audition for that, and I got into that. But my dad was perfectly willing. He said, there's nothing wrong with doing that for a living. He said, look at Danny LaRue. Look at that.
Exactly, great living.
Yeah.
Now, I was just reading about when you were at school, or when you were younger, your mum used to get you to draw. You enjoyed drawing and things like that, and she would get you to draw anything at the drop of a hat. I think when I was younger, I was always pushed up to get up and do a number and things like that. Mm. It's what happens, isn't it? They want to show you off in the right way. But then you were dissuaded from drawing by one of your Year 10 teachers.
Yes.
You know, and I hate reading those sort of stories where they, you know, put you off. But I found that quite ironic, because many, many years later, you got to use your talent for drawing by being a furniture designer for Nicholas Dattner, isn't it? Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yes.
Unbelievable.
17 years I did that on and off. So it was a very good job, because it's a well-paid job doing, it isn't just drafting, but in those days, illustrating. So we had a lot of corporate clients, and they'd say, or people, they'd say, I want to know what my boardroom's going to look like.
Yes,
so then
I'd do a full
interior in watercolor and that sort of thing. And I suppose that teacher would have looked at all the work I did and said that it was derivative and it all looked, she used to say, because I'd got away with being, everybody thought I was wonderful at drawing and, you know, that I would be an artist and I would be a designer or something like that. And I think she decided to burst my bubble big time and challenge me, because she said, you know, you've already got it all worked out and I want to open your eyes to other things. That's probably what she was wanting
to
do.
You don't think she was being a bitch?
At the time, I did.
Yes, because I do. I can't, I don't like her.
I used to go home and cry at night.
See, I don't think, how on earth is that, helpful? I mean, I realise, I know what you mean, when you challenge someone, but, I mean, to tell them that their work is rubbish and hope that they might, get something out of that is not a good idea.
No, I hated her guts,
yes,
actually.
Yes, I don't like her.
And because I'd had a teacher who really liked me and I really enjoyed her. She was wonderful. And so she encouraged me. And the thing was that this other teacher would put up somebody else's work, which I would have thought was very substandard, but admire the texture of it or admire where they were coming from. And they'd say, whereas John's is the same as what he always does.
Cow.
And the thing is that what most artists want, really, once they've arrived, is what makes it significant is that people can see your work and they can, that's a Picasso, that's a John Jackson, they can recognize your work.
Yes. Are you comparing yourself to Picasso now?
Why not?
Why not indeed?
Why not? No, but see, we'll never know because I never went. Because of that bitch. But that sort of propelled me into other things because I thought, well, I just can't get past her. So I just dropped art altogether and just didn't do it. But I still did drama at school and that was good.
Yes. Mm. Now, I want to get on to your second item. What would you like me to see about throwing into a hell in a handbasket?
Well, like Dolly, like what I like, really want like you to do like is to stop people using like as every second word, or some people it's nine of the ten words in the sentence. Yes.
And I think it comes from America, doesn't it, that one? Don't
I don't really like no.
Yes.
But I think it's also people with tiny vocabularies. They can't think of anything else, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah, cause, well, I mean, we've all got them. Different countries have got their own way of, those sort of, I can't bear it with ums. Is another
Tony Abbott. Every second thing that comes out of his mouth.
Yes, it's difficult when
the rest of it's rubbish
constantly
as well.
Having to give speeches all the time, but get better at it. I mean,
yes.
It's annoying, isn't it? And definitely with the likes, I think it's laziness, absolute laziness. And you're not one. I don't imagine you tolerate a lot of lazy people, do you?
No, not really. I'm not. Years gone by, I might have said something, but these days I'm a bit more careful.
You like an easier life, or you don't want the,
Well, if that's the kind of person they are, I don't want to hear any more. Right. So it's better just to leave it.
Listen, I think it's going to be an easy decision to put like into a Hell in a Handbasket, because it gets on my bloody nerves as well. Goodbye, like. You're off to Hell in a Handbasket. Oh, definitely, without a doubt. Now, your drama days then, so you studied drama, and you imagine you were quite the popular one when you studied it, were you?
Well, I guess so. I made a lot of friends there. A lot of my friends did drama, and I think it's a great outlet for people, whether you go on to be an actor or a singer or whatever. I think it's a great outlet for people.
And drama. Because you like to do mimicking, you like to mimic voice.
Oh, yes. Well, I think the first person I ever impersonated was my grade 3 teacher, Mrs. Pigeon. And I remember standing up in front of the class. She hadn't arrived yet, and I stood up, and she had her head in a bun, her hair in a bun, and a very long neck, and she used to roll her head around like that. And so I walked around the classroom and said, "Oh, I'm Mrs. Pigeon." And Evan Driver's looking at me going, no. And I looked over, and there she was standing right behind me. But she took it with good humour. She said,
"Wow, I'm surprised. I thought she was going to be an angry pigeon."
Yes, no. Well, she said to me, "Not bad, Mr. Jackson, not bad, but sit down."
Oh, I see that. That's what you want, isn't it? You want one like that. Oh, welcome back, everybody, into our last segment with the very lovely John Jackson. You look very comfortable with your feathers there.
Oh, thank you very much. They do. They help me. They help me feel secure at times.
Oh, it's always nice to have a bit of zhuzh, isn't it?
It is, because, you know, I don't get to do drag. Well, I don't do drag in the shows, but I do like to have a few of the trappings, you see. A little bit of slab.
Yes.
A
little bit of... Well, just makes it theatrical, doesn't it?
Well, it does. I mean, otherwise you just look at any other Joe on the street.
Yes, and I think that's always important, isn't it? I was always brought up that when you're going on stage, you certainly don't go about, well, you know, wearing anything that you would normally have as day wear or that sort of stuff.
I think that's true. I don't enjoy paying to see people look like they just walked in out,
in
out of a back alley.
In their denim jeans or something.
No. And their dirty jeans.
Awful, awful. Now, you've done a lot of work. I was looking at your work through Opera Australia. You were involved with for quite a while, weren't you?
I was. When I stopped doing cabaret shows, I think in 2000, and I was asked to write a libretto for Opera Australia.
Must have been an amazing opportunity.
It was. I thought, me? But they said, well, you know, you write really good cabaret shows, so we thought you might be good at writing the libretto. So they gave me the story, and I had to write the dialogue. So, you know, the libretto is what he says and what she sings and whatever. And I found it was very easy. I thought all of these things just sort of came to me very easily. And they teamed me up with a composer called Taron Carter, who was a saxophonist. And so he orchestrated this entire opera for the whole orchestra was saxophones, all different kinds.
Wow.
And it was really great. And I was able to have my choice of who was in it. And, so I got to sit on the other side of the audition desk for a change and have a say about who
played
my
characters.
I've
never done that. I'd like to do that.
It is. It's good. But it's good. But the sad thing is you've got somebody in front of you who is the most fantastic singer, like a really great talent, but they're not right for the role.
Yeah.
Because let's say the role, the guy is a dweeb. This is one character. This guy's a dweeb. And standing in front of me is Juan Jackson.
Yes.
You know, and I'm thinking he could never look or sound like a dweeb.
No.
And then Henry Chu, who's now a principal with Opera Australia, he's a tenor, came on and looking like a complete dag. He's got a voice like a god, but he looks like a complete dag. And he played the role beautifully.
And has it ever been done recently, or was it?
That was the only time it was done.
Wow.
The second opera I did with them was a Paul Grabowski opera. He composed it, and Joanna Murray Smith wrote the book. It was called Love in the Age of Therapy, which was a comic opera, a black comedy, let's say. And I got to play the narrator part, And it had a fantastic cast. It was sold out before it ever opened. And for some reason, it's never been done again. I don't know why. It was hugely successful. But I think that's what happens. They say, we'll keep it in repertoire. But I think by the time it ever happens again, I'll be too old to play it, to play the role. I think everybody else in it has retired. I think there's only about three of us who are still, or four of us who are still singing. Everybody else has retired.
And you went over for the Edinburgh Festival, haven't you? You've done that as well. That would have been exciting because it's always great when you're over there. But when you're doing the Edinburgh Festival, did you have to go out leafleting, or did you, you know, were you all looked after?
No, we were very well looked after. We were in a fantastic venue. And even though it was our first time, we were on a double bill with Rachel Berger.
Oh, the lovely Rachel.
And I think that she'd been there and she'd been successful before, and I think she pulled a crowd. And it was just one of those venues a lot of people went to. And the show, just our first night, we got a fantastic review from William Cook and The Scotsman.
Right, and that always sets you up, doesn't it?
And that's it.
Yeah.
It sold out after that. It was just a really strange experience to, you know, one minute you're here and you're working pubs, and the next minute you're over in the Edinburgh Festival and you're...
And they know how to look after their audiences, don't they? I think when you do something like the Edinburgh Festival... Well, when you have a good one anyway, when you have a good show, don't they? They're an appreciative crowd.
They're a great crowd. I mean, the press aren't.
The audiences soon let you know if you're not very good as well.
They sure do. There was a gig that a lot of comedians used to do after their shows, go over and do the university gig, and it was like a gladiator pit. So the actor was down there and the audience was up there surrounding them, and if they didn't like you, well, they just threw their beer cans at you.
Oh, I wouldn't like that.
No, I wouldn't do it. I was too frightened.
Now, we've got one more from you, John Jackson, one more item where we're going to decide where it goes to Hell in a Handbasket. I will warn you, very few people, in fact, I don't know if any, have had three items go, but good luck. I want to know what it is. Tell me.
Okay, so my third one is upper middle class women, very entitled women who drive very large four-wheel drives and have no manners. I mean, I'm just absolutely sick of them. They drive like they own the road and they're rude and they're stupid and they breed.
Now, whereabouts do you live? Is it in your area? Is this happening near where you live?
Yes, I live in the Bentley area.
Oh, yes.
It's a very aspiring suburb, I would say. And so we've got all the fabulous mummies, the yummy mummies.
Oh, yes.
And they're always in their yoga gear. They're on their way to yoga, or they're on their way to God knows what. And they're dropping the kids off at childcare, and it's just
marvelous.
It always
seems a little odd to me that there's one child in such a massive, you know, it's a sort of car that Arnold Schwarzenegger drives, isn't
it? Yeah, and they live in these enormous homes.
Yes, everything has to be large.
Yeah, they buy a family home, a three-bedroom family home, and turn it into a double-storey, there's just this enormous house with like five bedrooms, and there's still three of them.
Yes.
I mean, the kid leaves, well, the thing is, maybe it's because kids don't leave home these days. You know, 18, I was out of there.
Yes, but I think I was as well.
I think these days it's 48 and they're still, they still can't get rid of
them. I don't know how anyone would want to live at home at that age, or, you know, in their late 20s or 30s, absolutely not. But I think it's up to the mums and dads to get rid of them as well, though. It's, you know, works both ways. Now, I think they're also not great on the environment, are they, those sort of cars?
They're not.
I mean, I don't, you know, I haven't got into it generally, but they can't be.
Paul Keating said that if he was still Prime Minister, he'd tax the out of them.
Oh, I think you can say shit.
Oh, shit.
I think you already said earlier, didn't you?
I think shitty. I think that's different.
Well, listen, I think, you may be the first person we've had on that's picked three and been lucky with all three. I've made my decision, and yes, those gas-guzzling, taking up too much space, harmful to the environment cars are definitely going to go to hell in a handbasket. Oh, yes. Oh, Oh, you picked well there, John Jackson.
Oh, thank you.
You picked really well. Now, we have reached the end, and thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
Well, it's lovely to have you on, and as I say, such a unique voice, and I think people have had a good chance to hear you tonight on Joy. Thank you very much, John Jackson.
Thank you, Dolly.
You've been listening to a To Hell in a Handbasket podcast, proudly brought to you by Dolly Diamond, Joy 94.9 and Big Mouth Media.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.